They eat fast and pick up Bugsy and then drive over to Ethel's. Chris has had a falling out with Ethel's boyfriend, and Chris is going to move out everything she has stored there. It's still raining a little, everything seems dark and oppressive, and they carry boxes of her belongings down one flight of stairs and pack it into the Volvo. They fill the car with lamps and clothes and houseplants, and then squeeze themselves in and drive across town to the projects on Arthur Street. Thea doesn't go for Bugsy, as it turns out. She's already got a boyfriend. The four of them sit around talking and drinking beer for a while, and then the men have a terrible realization. They've forgotten the hot dogs. Murph, who's charged with buying food for the trip, won't get hot dogs on his own, so if they want any, they'll have to get them on their own. They drive to Cape Ann Market, and Bobby and Bugsy run into the store and come back a few minutes later with $50 worth of hot dogs. It's mid-afternoon now. It's getting close. Chris drives them back down Rogers Street, past Walgreens and Americold and Gorton's, and turns down into the gravel lot behind Rose's Marine. Bobby and Bugsy get out with their hot dogs and jump from the pier to the deck of the Andrea Gale. Watching the men move around the boat, Chris thinks, this winter, Bobby'll be down in Bradenton. Next summer, he'll be back up here, but gone a month at a time. And that's just how it is. Bobby's a sword fisherman and owes a lot of money. At least they have a plan, though. Bobby signed a statement directing Bob Brown to give his settlement check from the last trip to Chris. And she's going to use the money, almost $3,000, to pay off some of his debts and get an apartment in Lanesville on the north shore of Cape Ann. Maybe living out there, they'll spend a little less time at the Nest. And she's got two jobs lined up, one at the old farm inn in Rockport, and another taking care of the retarded son of a friend. They'll get by. Bobby might be away a lot, but they'll get by. Suddenly, there are shouts coming from the boat. Bugsy and Bobby are standing toe-to-toe on the wharf in the rain, wrenching a jug of bleach back and forth. Fists are coming up, and the bleach is going first one way, then another, and at any moment, it looks like one of them's going to roundhouse the other. It doesn't happen. Bobby finally turns away, spitting swears, and goes back to work. Out of the corner of her eye, Chris sees another fisherman named Sully angling across the gravel lot toward her car. He walks up and leans in the window. I just got a sight on the boat, he says. I'm replacing some guy who backed out. He looks over at Bobby and Bugsy. Can you believe this shit? 30 days together and it's starting already? The Andrea Gale, in the language, is a raked stem, hard-chinned, western rig sword fisherman. That means her bow has a lot of angle to it. She has a nearly square cross-section, and her pilot house is up front rather than in the stern, atop an elevated deck called the whaleback. She's 72 feet long, has a hull of continuously welded steel plate, and was built in Panama City, Florida, in 1978. She has a 365-horsepower turbocharged diesel engine, which is capable of speeds up to 12 knots. There are 7 Type 1 life preservers on board, 6 Imperial survival suits, a 406 megahertz emergency position indicating radio beacon, EPIRB, a 121.5 megahertz EPIRB, and a Givens auto-inflating life raft. There are 40 miles of 700-pound test monofilament line on her, thousands of hooks, and room for 5 tons of bait fish. An ice machine that can make 3 tons of ice a day sits on her whaleback deck, and state-of-the-art electronics fill her pilot house. Radar, Loran, single sideband, VHF, WeatherTrack satellite receiver. There's a washer-dryer on board, and the galley has fake wood veneer and a 4-burner stove. The Andrea Gale is one of the biggest moneymakers in Gloucester Harbor, and Billy Tyne and Bugsy Moran have driven all the way from Florida to grab sights on board. The only other sword boat in the harbor that might be able to outfish her is the Hannah Bowden, skippered by a Colby College graduate named Linda Greenlaw. Not only is Greenlaw one of the only women in the business, she's one of the best captains, period, on the entire East Coast. Year after year, trip after trip, she makes more money than almost anyone else. Both the Andrea Gale and the Hannah Bowden are owned by Bob Brown, and they can take so much fish from the ocean that Ethel's son, Ricky, has been known to call in from Hawaii to find out if either one is in port. When the Hannah Bowden unloads her catch in Gloucester, swordfish prices plummet halfway across the world. So far, though, Billy's second trip on the Andrea Gale is off to a bad start. The boys have been drinking hard all week, and everyone's in a foul mood. No one wants to go back out. For the past several days, almost every attempt to work on the boat has degenerated either into a fight or an occasion to walk across the street to the bar. Now it's September 20th, late in the season to be heading out, and Tyne can barely round up a full crew. Alfred Pierre, an immense, kind Jamaican from New York City, is holed up with his girlfriend in one of the upstairs rooms at the Nest. One minute he says he's going, the next minute he's not. It's been like that all day long. Bobby's somewhere across town with a black eye and a hangover. Bugsy's in an ugly mood because he hasn't met a woman. Murph is complaining about money and misses his kid. And the last straw, a new crew member walked off this morning without any explanation at all. The guy's name was Adam Randall, and he was supposed to replace Doug Costco, who'd crewed on the previous trip. Randall had driven up from East Bridgewater, Massachusetts, with his father-in-law that morning to take the job. He pulled into the dirt parking lot behind Rose's and got out to look the boat over. Randall was a lithe, intensely handsome 30-year-old man with a shag of blonde rock star hair and cold blue eyes. He was a welder, an engineer, a scuba diver, and had fished his whole life. He knew an unsafe boat when he saw one. He called them slabs, and the Andrea Gale was anything but. She looked like she could take an aircraft carrier broadside. Moreover, he knew most of her crew, and his girlfriend had practically told him not to bother coming home if he didn't take the job. He hadn't worked in 3 months. He walked back across the lot, told his father-in-law that he had a funny feeling, and the two of them drove off together to a bar. People often get premonitions when they do jobs that could get them killed. And in commercial fishing, still one of the most dangerous pursuits in the country, people get premonitions all the time. The trick is knowing when to listen to them. In 1871, a cook named James Nelson shipped aboard the schooner Sachem for a fishing trip to George's Bank. One night, he was awakened by a recurring dream and ran aft to tell the captain. "For God's sake, get clear of the banks," he begged. "I've had my dream again. I've been shipwrecked twice after this dream." The captain was an old salt named Wenzel. He asked what the dream was. "I see women dressed in white standing in the rain," Nelson replied. There was hardly a breath of wind, and Wenzel was not impressed. He told Nelson to go back to bed. A while later, a little breeze sprang up. Within an hour, it was blowing hard, and the Sachem was hove to under close-reefed foresail. The hull started to open up, and the crew manned the pumps. They couldn't keep up with the leak, and Wenzel desperately signaled to a nearby Gloucester schooner, the Pescador. The Pescador put dories over the side and managed to save the Sachem's crew. Within half an hour, the Sachem rolled over, settled bow down into the sea, and sank. Even today, instincts are heeded and fears are listened to. Randall walked off, and suddenly Tyne had another sight to fill. He called around and finally got 28-year-old David Sullivan. Sully, as he's known, was mildly famous in town for having saved his entire crew one frigid January night. His boat, the Harmony, was tied to another boat when she began to take on water out at sea. Her crew started screaming for help, but couldn't wake up the men on the other boat, so Sully jumped overboard and pulled himself across on a rope, legs dragging through the icy North Atlantic. Sullivan, in other words, was a good man to have on board. Tynes said he'd be over to pick him up in half an hour. Sully packed a bag and made a few phone calls to tell people he'd be away for a while. Suddenly, his plans for that evening were off. His life was on hold for the next month. Billy showed up around 2 o'clock, and they drove back to Rose's just in time to see Bobby and Bugsy going at it. Wonderful, Sully thought. He stopped to say hello to Chris, and then Billy sent him off to the Cape Ann market to get the food for the trip. Murph went with him. Bulging in Sully's pocket was $4,000 cash. One of the things about commercial fishing is that everything seems to be extreme. Fishermen don't work in any normal sense of the word. They're at sea for a month, and then home celebrating for a week straight. They don't earn the same kind of money most other people do. They come home either busted or with $250,000 worth of fish in their hold. And when they buy food for the month, it's not something any normal person would recognize as shopping. It's a retail catastrophe of biblical proportions. Murph and Sully drive to the Cape Ann Market out on Route 127 and begin stalking up and down the aisles, throwing food into their carts by the armful. They grab 50 loaves of bread, enough to fill 2 carts. They take 100 pounds of potatoes, 30 pounds of onions, 25 gallons of milk, $80 racks of steak. Every time they fill a cart, they push it to the back of the store and get another one. The herd of carts starts to grow. 10, 15, 20 carts, and people stare nervously and get out of the way. Murph and Sully grab anything they want and lots of it. Ice cream sandwiches, Hostess cupcakes, bacon and eggs, creamy peanut butter, porterhouse steaks, chocolate-coated cereal, spaghetti, lasagna, frozen pizza. They get top-of-the-line food, and the only thing they don't get is fish. Finally, they get 30 cartons of cigarettes, enough to fill a whole cart, and round their carts up like so many stainless steel cattle. The store opens 2 cash registers, especially for them, and it takes half an hour to ring them through. The total nearly cleans Sully out. He pays while Murph backs the truck up to a loading dock, and they heave the food on, and then drive it down to Rose's Wharf. Bag by bag, they carry $4,000 worth of groceries down into the fish hold of the Andrea Gale. The Andrea Gale has a small refrigerator in the galley and 20 tons of ice in the hold. The ice keeps the bait fish and groceries from spoiling on the way out, and the swordfish from spoiling on the way home. In a pinch, it can even be used to keep a dead crew member fresh. Once, a desperately alcoholic old fisherman died on the Hannah Bowden, and Linda Greenlaw had to put him down the hole because the Coast Guard refused to fly him out. Commercial fishing simply wouldn't be possible without ice. Without diesel engines, maybe. Without Loran, weather faxes, or hydraulic winches. But not without ice. There's simply no other way to get fresh fish to market. In the old days, Grand Banks fishermen used to run to Newfoundland to salt dry their catch before heading home. But the coming of the railroads in the 1840s changed all that. Suddenly, food could be moved faster than it would spoil, and ice companies sprang up practically overnight to accommodate the new market. They cut ice from ponds in the winter, packed it in sawdust, and then sold it to schooners in the summer months. Properly packed ice lasted so long and was so valuable that traders could ship it to India and still make a profit. The market for fresh fish changed fishing forever. No longer could schooner captains return home at their leisure with a hold full of salt cod. Now it was all one big race. Several full schooners pulling into port at once could saturate the market and ruin the efforts of anyone following. In the 1890s, one schooner had to dump 200 tons of halibut into Gloucester Harbor because she'd been beaten into port by six other vessels. Overloaded schooners built like racing sloops dashed home through fall gales with every inch of canvas showing and their decks practically awash. Bad weather sank these elegant craft by the dozen, but a lot of people made a lot of money. And in cities like Boston and New York, people were suddenly eating fresh Atlantic cod. Little has changed. Fishing boats still make the same mad dashes for shore they were making 150 years ago. And the smaller boats, the ones that don't have ice machines, are still buying it in bulk from Cape Pond Ice, located in a low brick building between Felicia Oil and Parisi Seafoods. In the old days, Cape Pond used to hire men to carve up a local pond with huge ice saws. But now the ice is made in row upon row of 350-pound blocks called cans. The cans look like huge versions of the trays in people's refrigerators. They're extracted from freezers in the floor, skidded onto elevators, hoisted to the third floor, and dragged down a runway by men wielding huge steel hooks. The men work in a building-sized refrigerator and wear shirts that say, Cape Pond Ice, the coolest guys around. The ice blocks are shoved down a chute into a steel cutting drum, where they jump and rattle in terrible spasms until all 350 pounds have been eaten down to little chips and sprayed through a hose into the hold of a commercial boat outside. Cape Pond is one of hundreds of businesses jammed into the Gloucester waterfront. Boats come into port, offload their catch, and then spend the next week making repairs and gearing up for the next trip. A good-sized wave can bury a sword boat underwater for a few seconds. It just gets real dark in here, is how Linda Greenlaw describes the experience, and undoing the effects of a drubbing like that can take days, even weeks. One boat came into port twisted. Most boats are repaired at Gloucester Marine Railways, a haul-out place that's been in business since 1856. It consists of a massive wooden frame that rides steel rollers along two lengths of railroad track up out of the water. 600-ton boats are blocked up, lashed down, and hauled ashore by a double shot of one-inch chain worked off a series of huge steel reduction gears. The gears were machined 100 years ago and haven't been touched since. There are three railways in all, one in the inner harbor and two out on Rocky Neck. The Harbor Railway is the least robust of the three and terminates in a greasy little basement which sports a pair of strangely Moorish-looking brick arches. The other two railways are surrounded by the famous galleries and piano bars of Rocky Neck. Tourists blithely wander past machinery that could rip their summer homes right off their foundations. The Andrea Gale had been touched up at the railways, but most of her major work was done in St. Augustine, Florida, in 1987. Almost 3 feet were added to her stern to accommodate two 1,900-gallon fuel tanks. The whaleback deck was extended aft 9 feet, and a steel bulwark on the port side was raised and extended 18 feet. In addition, 28 fuel oil drums, 7 water drums, and the ice machine were stored on the whaleback. In all, perhaps about 10 tons of steel, fuel, and machinery were added to the whaleback. The weight had been added high up, 8 feet or so above the deck, and perhaps twice that high above the waterline. The boat's center of gravity had been changed just a little. The Andrea Gale would now sit more deeply in the water, recover from rolls a bit more slowly. On the other hand, she could now put to sea for 6 weeks at a time. That, after all, was the point. And no man on the boat would have disagreed. God's country. Going to sea is going to prison, with a chance at drowning besides. Samuel Johnson. By mid-afternoon, the Andrea Gale is ready. The food and bait have been stowed away. The fuel and water tanks have been topped off. Spare drums of both have been lashed onto the whaleback. The gear's in good order, and the engine's running well. All there remains to do is leave. Bobby climbs off the boat without saying anything to Bugsy. They're still morose after their fight, and walks across the parking lot to Chris's Volvo. They drive back across town to Thea's and trot up her front steps in a soft, warm rain. Thea hears their feet on the stoop and invites them in and takes her cue from a quick glance from Chris. "I've got some errands to do. I'll be back in a few hours," she says. "Make yourselves at home." Chris and Bobby tug each other into the dark bedroom and lie down on the bed. Outside, the rain taps on. Chris and Bobby can't see the ocean, but they can smell it, a dank taste of salt and seaweed that permeates the entire peninsula and lays claim to it as part of the sea. On rainy days, there's no getting away from it. Wherever you go, you breathe in that smell, and this is one of those days. Chris and Bobby lie together on Thea's bed, talking and smoking and trying to forget the fact that this is his last day. And after an hour, the phone rings and Bobby jumps up to answer it. It's Sully on the line, calling from the crow's nest. "It's 5 o'clock, Sully says. Time to go. The mood is dark and grim when they get down to the nest. Alfred Pierre is still locked in an upstairs room with his girlfriend and won't come out. Billy Tynes just returned from a 2-hour phone conversation with his ex-wife, Jody. Murph's there with a pile of toys on the pool table, packing them into a cardboard box. Ethel's in the back room crying. Bobby's money problems, the black eye, the month offshore. The Grand Banks in October is no joke, and everybody knows it. There won't be half a dozen boats out there from the whole East Coast fleet. Alfred Pierre finally comes down and sidles into the bar. He's a big, shy man who's not well-known around town, although people seem to like him. His girlfriend has come down from Maine to see him off, and she's not handling it well. Her eyes are red, and she's holding him as if she might physically keep him from getting on the boat. Murph finishes strapping his package up with tape and asks Chris to run him across town on an errand. He wants to pick up some movies. Sully is talking to Bugsy in a corner, and everyone's congratulating Ethel's eldest son, Rusty, for his upcoming marriage next week. Most of the people in the room will be 1,000 miles into the North Atlantic by then. Chris and Murph return 10 minutes later with a cardboard box spilling with videos. There's a VCR on the Andrea Gale, and someone off another boat offered Murph the movies. Alfred has a beer bottle clenched in one big hand and is still muttering about not wanting to go. Sully's saying the same thing. He's in a yellow slicker over by the pool table telling Bugsy how he's got a bad feeling about this trip. "It's the money," he says. "If I didn't need the money, I wouldn't go near this thing." "Okay, you guys," Billy says. "One last drink." Everyone downs one last drink. "Okay, one more," someone says. Everyone has one more. Bobby's drinking tequila. He's standing by Chris, looking down at the floor, and she's holding his hand, and neither of them is saying much. Sully comes over and asks if they're going to be okay. Chris says, "Sure, we'll be fine," and then she says, "Actually, I'm not sure. Actually, no, I don't think so." 6 men are leaving for a month, and it feels as if things are shearing off into a new and empty direction from which they may never return. Ethel, trying to maintain her composure, goes around the room hugging all the men. The only person she doesn't hug is Alfred, because she doesn't know him well enough. Bobby asks his mother if they can take the color TV above the bar. "If it's okay with Billy," she says. Billy looks up. "Ethel," he says, "they can take the TV, but if they watch it instead of doing their work, it's going straight overboard. That's fine, Billy, that's fine, Ethel says. Billy's girlfriend sees Bobby's shiner under the brim of his Budweiser cap and glances over at Chris. She's of the old school where ladies don't slug their men. You northern gals, she says. I didn't mean it, says Chris. It was a mistake. It's now way too late for anyone to back out. Not in the literal sense. Any one of them could still take off running out the door. But people don't work like that. More or less, they do what others expect them to. If one of the crew backed out now, he'd sit around for a month and then either go to a welcome home party or a memorial service. Either would be horrible in its own way. Half the crew have misgivings about this trip, but they're going anyhow. They've crossed some invisible line, and now even the most desperate premonitions won't save them. Tyne, Pierre, Sullivan, Moran, Murphy, and Shatford are going to the Grand Banks on the Andrea Gale. Okay, Billy says, let's go. Everyone files out the big wooden door. The rain has stopped, and there are even a few scraps of clear sky off to the west. Pale late summer blue. Chris and Bobby get into her Volvo, and Alfred and his girlfriend get into their car, and everyone else walks. They cross Rogers Street through the impatient stream of Friday afternoon traffic, and then angle down through the gate in the chain-link fence. There are fuel tanks on iron scaffolds behind roses, and small boats up with tarps over them, and a battered sign that says, Carter's Boatyard. One of the fuel tanks has a pair of humpback whales painted on it. Chris drives past the little group, tires crunching on the gravel, and comes to a stop in front of the Andrea Gale. The boat is tied up to a small piece of wharf behind Old Port Seafoods, next to the fireboat and a dockside fuel pump. Bobby looks over at her. I don't want to do this, he says. I really don't. Chris is holding on to him in the front seat of her Volvo, with everything she owns in the back. Well, don't go then, she says. Well, fuck it. Don't go. I got to go. The money, I got to. Billy Tyne walks over and leans in the window. You gonna be all right, he asks. Chris nods her head. Bobby is really starting to fight the tears, and he looks away so that Billy doesn't see. Okay, Billy says to Chris. We'll see you when we get back. He walks across the dock and jumps down onto the deck of the boat. Then Sully comes over. He's known Bobby most of his life. Without Bobby, he probably wouldn't even have taken the trip. And he's worried about him now. Worried that somehow Bobby isn't going to make it, that the trip's a huge mistake. Are you two okay, he says. Are you sure? Yeah, we're okay, says Chris. We just need a minute. Sully smiles and slaps the car roof and walks away. Bugsy and Murph don't have anyone to linger over, and so they waste no time getting on the boat. Now it's just the two couples in their cars. Alfred detaches himself from his girlfriend in the front seat and gets out and walks across the dock. His girlfriend looks around, crying, and spots Chris in the Volvo. She draws two fingers down her cheeks. Yes, I'm sad too. And then just sits there, tears running down her cheeks. There's nothing more to wait for now, nothing more to say. Bobby's trying to keep it together because of the other five guys on the boat, but Chris is not trying to keep it together. Well, I gotta go now, he says. Yep. And Christina, you know I'll always love you. She smiles at him through her tears. Yeah, I know, she says. Bobby kisses her and gets out of the car, still holding hands. He closes the door and gives her a final smile and then starts walking across the gravel. As Chris remembers it, he doesn't look back, not once, and he keeps his face hidden the entire way. Almost as soon as the New World was discovered, Europeans were fishing it. 12 years after Columbus, a Frenchman named Jean Denis crossed the Atlantic, worked the Grand Banks off Newfoundland, and returned home with a hold full of cod. Within a few years, there were so many Portuguese boats on the banks that their king felt compelled to impose an import tax in order to protect the fishermen at home. Codfish ran so thick off Newfoundland, it was said, that they slowed ships down in the water. Codfish weren't quite that plentiful, but they were certainly worth crossing the Atlantic for, and they were easily transported. Crews salted them aboard ship, dried them when they got home, and then sold them by the hundreds of thousands. The alternative was to go over with two crews, one to fish and another to preserve the catch on shore. The fish were split down the middle and then laid on racks called flakes to cure all summer in the Newfoundland air. Either way, the result was a rugged slab of protein that could be treated as indelicately as shoe leather and then soaked back to a palatable form. Soon, European ships were shuttling back and forth across the North Atlantic in a hugely lucrative, if perilous, trade. For the first 50 years, the European powers were content to fish off Newfoundland and leave the coastlines alone. They were jagged, gloomy places that seemed to offer little more than a chance to impale one's ship. Then, in 1598, a French marquis named Troilus de Méguay pulled 60 convicts from French prisons and deposited them on a barren strip of sand called Sable Island, south of Nova Scotia. Left to shift for themselves, the men hunted wild cattle, constructed huts from shipwrecked vessels, rendered fish oil, and gradually killed one another off. By 1603, there were only 11 left alive, and these unfortunates were dragged back to France and presented to King Henry IV. They were clothed in animal skins and had beards halfway down their chests. Not only did the king pardon them their crimes, he gave them a bounty to make up for their suffering. It was around this time that Cape Ann was first sighted by Europeans. In 1605, the great French explorer Samuel de Champlain was working his way south from Casco Bay, Maine, when he rounded the rock ledges of Thatcher's, Milk, and Salt Islands and cast anchor off a sandy beach. The natives drew for him a map of the coastline to the south, and Champlain went on to explore the rest of New England before returning to Cape Ann the following year. This time he was clawing his way up the coast in some ugly fall weather when he sought shelter in a natural harbor he'd missed on his previous trip. He was greeted by a party of Abenaki Indians, some of whom wore the scraps of Portuguese clothing they had traded for 100 years before, and they made a great show of hospitality before launching a surprise attack from the woods of Eastern Point. The Frenchmen easily fended them off, and on the last day of September 1606, with the Indians waving goodbye from the shore and the oaks and maples rusting into their fall colors, Champlain set sail again. Because of the sheltered coves and thick shellfish beds, he called the place Beauport, the Good Harbor. 17 years later, a group of Englishmen sailed into Beauport, eyed the local abundance of cod, and cast their anchor. The year was 1623. The ship was financed by the Dorchester Company, a group of London investors that wanted to start tapping the riches of the New World. Their idea was to establish a settlement on Cape Ann and use it to support a fleet of boats that would fish all spring and summer and return to Europe in the fall. The shore crew was charged with building a habitable colony and drying the catch as it came in. Unfortunately, luck was against the Dorchester men from the start. The first summer they caught a tremendous amount of fish, but the bottom dropped out of the cod market, and they didn't even make expenses. The next year prices returned to normal, but they caught almost no fish at all. And the third year, violent gales damaged the boats and drove them back to England. The company was forced to liquidate its assets and bring its men home. A few of the settlers refused to leave, though. They combine forces with a band of outcasts from the tyrannical Plymouth colony and form the nucleus of a new colony at Gloucester. New England was an unforgiving land in those days, where only the desperate and the devout seemed to survive, and Gloucester wound up with more than its share of the former. Its most notorious citizen was the Reverend John Lyford, whose deeds were so unchristian he criticized the church and groped a local servant girl, as to be deemed unprintable by a local historian. Another was a shipwrecked adventurer named Fells, who fled Plymouth to escape public whipping. His crime was that he'd had unsanctioned relations with a young woman. Gloucester was a perfect place for loose cannons like Lyford and Fells. It was poor, remote, and the Puritan fathers didn't particularly care what went on up there. After a brief period of desertion, the town was resettled in 1631, and almost immediately the inhabitants took to fishing. They had little choice, Cape Ann being one big rock, but in some ways that was a blessing. Farmers are easy to control because they're tied to their land, but fishermen are not so easy to control. A 20-year-old off a 3-month trip to the Banks has precious little reason to heed the bourgeois mores of the town. Gloucester developed a reputation for tolerance, if not outright debauchery, that drew people from all over the Bay Colony. The town began to thrive. Other communities also had a healthy streak of godlessness in them, but it was generally relegated to the outskirts of town. Wellfleet, for example, reserved an island across the harbor for its young men. In due time, a brothel, a tavern, and a whale lookout were built there, just about everything a young fisherman needed. Gloucester had no such buffer, though. Everything happened right on the waterfront. Young women avoided certain streets, town constables were on the lookout for errant fishermen, and orchard owners rigged guns up to tripwires to protect their apple trees. Some Gloucester fishermen, apparently, didn't even respect the Sabbath. Cape Cod captains went wild-eyed in an agony of inner conflict, recorded a Cape Cod historian named Joseph Berger, as they read the scriptures to their crews, while some godless Gloucester craft lay in plain sight, hauling up a full share of mackerel or cod. If the fishermen lived hard, it was no doubt because they died hard as well. In the industry's heyday, Gloucester was losing a couple of hundred men every year to the sea, 4% of the town's population. Since 1650, an estimated 10,000 Gloucestermen have died at sea, far more Gloucestermen than died in all the country's wars. Sometimes a storm would hit the Grand Banks and half a dozen ships would go down, 100 men lost overnight. On more than one occasion, Newfoundlanders woke up to find their beaches strewn with bodies. The Grand Banks are so dangerous because they happen to sit on one of the worst storm tracks in the world. Low-pressure systems form over the Great Lakes, or Cape Hatteras, and follow the jet stream out to sea, crossing right over the fishing grounds in the process. In the old days, there wasn't much the boats could do but put out extra anchor cable and try to ride it out. As dangerous as the Grand Banks were, though, George's Bank, only 180 miles east of Cape Cod, was even worse. There was something so ominous about George's that fishing captains refused to go near it for 300 years. Currents ran in strange vortexes on George's, and the tide was said to run off so fast that ocean bottom was left exposed for gulls to feed on. Men talked of strange dreams and visions they had there, and the uneasy feeling that dire forces were assembling themselves. Unfortunately, George's was also home to one of the greatest concentrations of marine life in the world, and it was only a matter of time before someone tried to fish it. In 1827, a Gloucester skipper named John Fletcher Wonson hove to off George's, threw out a fishing line, and pulled up a halibut. The ease with which the fish had been caught stuck in his mind, and 3 years later, he went back to George's expressly to fish. Nothing particularly awful happened, and soon ships were going back and forth to George's without a second thought. It was only a one-day trip from Gloucester, and the superstitions about the place started to fade. That was when George's turned deadly. Because the fishing grounds were so small and close to shore, dozens of schooners might be anchored within sight of each other on a fair day. If a storm came on gradually, the fleet had time to weigh anchor and disperse into deeper water. But a sudden storm could pile ship upon ship until they all went down in a mass of tangled spars and rigging. Men would be stationed at the bow of each boat to cut their anchor cables if another boat were bearing down on them, but that was usually a death sentence in itself. The chances of sailing clear of the shoal water were horribly small. One of the worst of these catastrophes happened in 1862, when a winter gale bore down on 70 schooners that were working a closely packed school of cod. Without warning, the sky turned black and the snow began to drive down almost horizontally. One fisherman described what ensued. "My shipmates showed no sign of fear. They were now all on deck, and the skipper was keeping a sharp lookout. Somewhere about 9 o'clock, the skipper sang out, 'There's a vessel adrift right ahead of us. Stand by with your hatchet, but don't cut until you hear the word.' All eyes were bent now on the drifting craft. On she came, directly at us. A moment more, and the signal to cut must be given. With the swiftness of a gull, she passed by, so near that I could have leaped aboard. The hopeless, terror-stricken faces of the crew we saw but a moment as the doomed craft sped on her course. She struck one of the fleet a short distance astern, and we saw the waters close over both vessels almost instantly." A few modern sword-fishing boats still fish George's Bank, but most make the long trip to the Grand. They're out for longer, but come back with more fish, the old trade-off. It takes a week to reach the Grand Banks on a modern sword boat. You drive east-northeast around the clock until you're 1,200 miles out of Gloucester and 400 miles out of Newfoundland. From there, it's easier to get to the Azores than back to the Crow's Nest. Like George's, the Grand Banks are shallow enough to allow sunlight to penetrate all the way to the bottom. An infusion of cold water called the Labrador Current crosses the shoals and creates the perfect environment for plankton. Small fish collect to feed on the plankton, and big fish collect to feed on the small fish. Soon the whole food chain's there, right up to the 70-foot sword boats. The trips in and out are basically the parts of the month that sword fishermen sleep. In port, they're too busy cramming as much life as they can into 5 or 6 days, and on the fishing grounds, they're too busy working. They work 20 hours a day for 2 or 3 weeks straight, and then fall into their bunks for the long steam back. The trips entail more than just eating and sleeping, though. Fishing gear, like deck gear, takes a terrific amount of abuse and must be repaired constantly. The crew doesn't want to waste a day's fishing because their gear's messed up, so they tend to it on the way out. They sharpen hooks, tie gangens, tie ball drops, set up the leader cart, check the radio buoys. At the Hague Line, where they enter Canadian waters, they must stow the gear in accordance with international law and are briefly without anything to do. They sleep, talk, watch TV, and read. There are high school dropouts who go through half a dozen books on the Grand Banks. Around 8 or 9 at night, the crew squeeze into the galley and shovel down whatever the cook has put together. Murph is the cook on the Andrea Gale. He's paid extra and stands watch while the other men eat. At dinner, the crew talk about what men everywhere talk about. Women, lack of women, kids, sports, horse racing, money, lack of money, work. They talk a lot about work. They talk about it the way men in prison talk about time. Work is what's keeping them from going home, and they all want to go home. The more fish they catch, the sooner the trip's over, which is a simple equation that turns them all into amateur marine biologists. After dinner, someone takes his turn at the dishes, and Billy goes back up to the wheelhouse so Murph can eat. No one likes washing dishes, so guys sometimes trade the duty for a pack of cigarettes. The longer the trip, the cheaper labor gets, until a $50,000-a-year fisherman is washing dishes for a single smoke. Dinner, at the end of such a trip, might be a bowl of croutons with salad dressing. Everyone on the crew stands watch twice a day. The shifts are 2 hours long and involve little more than watching the radar and occasionally punching numbers into the autopilot. If the gear is out, the night watches might have to jog back onto the main line to keep from drifting too far away. The Andrea Gale has a padded chair in her wheelhouse, but it's set back from the helm so that no one can fall asleep on watch. The radar and Loran are bolted to the ceiling, along with the VHF and single sideband, and the video plotter and autopilot are on the control panel to the left. There are 9 Lexan windows and a pistol grip spotlight that protrudes from the ceiling. The wheel is the size of a bicycle tire and positioned at the very center of the helm, about waist high. There's no reason to touch the wheel unless the boat has been taken off autopilot. And there's almost no reason to take the boat off autopilot. From time to time, the helmsman checks the engine room, but otherwise he just stares out at sea. Strangely, the sea doesn't get tedious to look at. Wave trains converge and crisscross in patterns that have never happened before and will never happen again. It can take hours to tear one's eyes away. Billy Tynes been out to the Grand Banks dozens of times before, but he's also fished off the Carolinas, Florida, and deep into the Caribbean. He grew up on Gloucester Avenue, near where Route 128 crosses the Anisquam River, and married a teenaged girl who lived a few blocks away. Billy was exceptional for downtown Gloucester in that he didn't fish, and his family was relatively well off. He ran a Mexican import business for a while, worked for a vault manufacturer, sold waterbeds. His older brother was killed at age 21 by a landmine in Vietnam, and perhaps Billy drew the conclusion that life wasn't something to be pissed away in a bar. He enrolled in school, set his sights on being a psychologist, and started counseling drug-addicted teenagers. He was searching for something, trying out different lives, but nothing seemed to fit. He dropped out of school and started working again, but by then he had a wife and 2 daughters to support. His wife Jody had been urging him to give fishing a try because she had a cousin whose husband made a lot of money at it. "You never know," she told him. "You just might like it." "It was all over after that," says Jody. "The men don't know anything else once they do it. They love it, and it takes over. And that's the bottom line. People get possessed with church or God, and fishing's just another thing they're possessed with. It's something inside of them that nobody can take away, and if they're not doing it, they're not gonna be happy." It helped, of course, that Billy was good at it. He had an uncanny ability to find fish, a deep sense of where they were. "It was weird. It was like he had radar," says Jody. "He was one of the few guys who could go out and catch fish all the time. Everyone always wanted to fish with him because he always made money." Tyne's very first trip was on the Andrea Gale, and after that he switched over to the Linnea C, owned by a man named Warren Cannon. Tyne and Cannon became close friends, and for 8 years, Cannon taught him everything he knew. After his long apprenticeship, Tyne decided to go out on his own, and he began to take out the Haddit, that fucking Clorox bottle, as Charlie Reed called it. It was a fiberglass boat. By this time, Tyne was fully hooked. The strains of being at sea had split up his marriage, but he still wouldn't give it up. He moved to Florida to be closer to his ex-wife and daughters, and fished harder than ever. Every summer, Tyne's two daughters, Erica and Billy Joe, went up to Gloucester to visit their grandparents, and Tyne would stop over between trips to see them. He also kept in touch with Charlie Reed, and when Reed stepped down from the Andrea Gale, Billy's name came up. Brown offered him a site as skipper of the boat, and one-third of the crew share. It was a good deal. A man like Tyne could clear $100,000 a year that way. He accepted. In the meantime, Reed got a job on a 90-foot steel dragger called the Corey Pride. He'd make less money, but he'd spend more time at home. "I just couldn't get into the gypsy life anymore," Reed says. "Moving around, not coming home 3 months at a time. I got by, but it was hell on my wife. And I thought I'd made enough to keep all my kids in school. I hadn't, but I thought I had." The Andrea Gale rides out to the fishing grounds on the back of a high-pressure system that comes bulging out of Canada. The winds are out of the northwest, and the skies are a deep, sharp blue. These are the prevailing winds for the area. They're the reason people say down east when they refer to northeast Maine. Schooners that hauled eastward downwind could be in St. John's or Halifax within 24 hours. A 365-horsepower diesel engine makes the effect less pronounced, but heading out is still a shorter trip than heading in. By September 26th or 27th, Billy Tyne's around 42 north and 49 west, about 300 miles off the tip of Newfoundland, in a part of the Grand Banks known as the Tail. Canadian national waters, which extend 200 miles offshore, exclude foreign boats from most of the banks, but two small sections protrude to the northeast and southeast, the nose and the tail. Sword boats patrol an arc hinging on a spot around 50 degrees west and 44 degrees north. Inside that arc are the broad, fertile submarine plains of the Grand Banks, off limits to all but Canadian boats and licensed foreign boats. Outside that arc are thousands of legal swordfish that might conceivably be fooled by a mackerel hung on a big steel hook. Swordfish are not gentle animals. They swim through schools of fish, slashing wildly with their swords, trying to eviscerate as many as possible. Then they feast. Swordfish have attacked boats, pulled fishermen to their deaths, slashed fishermen on deck. The scientific name for swordfish is Xiphias gladius. The first word means sword in Greek, and the second word means sword in Latin. The scientist who named it was evidently impressed by the fact that it had a sword, as one guidebook says. The sword, which is a bony extension of the upper jaw, is deadly sharp on the sides and can grow to a length of 4 or 5 feet. Backed up by 500 pounds of sleek, muscular fish, the weapon can do quite a bit of damage. Swordfish have been known to drive their swords right through the hulls of boats. Usually this doesn't happen unless the fish has been hooked or harpooned. But in the 19th century, a swordfish attacked a clipper ship for no apparent reason. The ship was so badly damaged that the owner applied to his insurer for compensation, and the whole affair wound up in court. Grand Banks swordfish spawn in the Caribbean and then edge northward during the summer months, heading for the cold, protein-rich waters off Newfoundland. During the daylight hours, the fish work their way down the water column to depths of 3,000 feet, chasing squid, hake, cod, butterfish, bluefish, mackerel, menhaden, and bonito. And at night, they follow their prey back up to the surface. Their young hatch with scales and teeth, but no sword, and have been described as wistful-looking. Although all manner of fish feed on larval swordfish, only mako, sperm whale, and killer whale attack them when they're fully grown. Mature swordfish are considered to be one of the most dangerous game fish in the world, and have been known to fight non-stop for 3 or 4 hours. They have sunk small boats in their struggles. Sport fishermen need live bait on heavy steel hooks that are secured to 500-pound test steel wire, or chain, to catch swordfish. They also need a numbing club on board to beat the fish senseless. Commercial fishermen, who are in the business of avoiding the thrill of fishing, use different methods entirely. They hang 1,000 baited hooks on 40 miles of monofilament and then crawl into bed to get some sleep. Bob Brown doesn't know when Billy makes his first set, because Billy hates talking to him on the radio. He's been known to leave messages with Linda Greenlaw in order not to talk to Bob Brown. He's been known to fake static on the single sideband. But it's reasonable to assume that on the night of September 27th, Tyne's making his first set of the trip. The boat's outriggers are boomed out, and 2 steel plates, known as birds, hang by chain down into the water to provide stability. The ocean has already settled into the galloping darkness of mid-autumn, and the wind has swung around to the southeast. The surface of the ocean is cross-hatched with changing weather. Baiting has all the glamour of a factory shift, and considerably more of the danger. The line is spooled on a big Lindegren drum that sits under the shelter of the whaleback on the port side of the boat. It crosses diagonally over the deck, passes through an overhead block, and then bends straight back toward the stern. A steel ring guides it over the rail and into the water. That's where the baiters stand. There's a bait table on top of the stern rail, basically a wooden well with squid and mackerel in it, and a leader cart on either side. The leader carts are small drums spooled with hundreds of lengths of 7-fathom line called ganjins. Each ganjin has a number 10 hook at one end and a stainless steel snap on the other. The baiter reaches behind him and takes a ganjin from his backup man, who's peeling them off the leader cart one at a time. The baiter impales a squid or mackerel onto the hook, snaps the ganjin onto the main line, and throws the whole thing over the side. The hook is easily big enough to pass through a man's hand, and if it catches some part of the baiter's body or clothing, he goes over the side with it. For this reason, baiters have complete control over the hook. No one handles the ganjin while they're on it. There's also a knife holstered to the baiting table. A baiter might, conceivably, grab it fast enough to sever the line before going over. Since swordfish feed at night, each hook is also fixed with a Siloom light stick that illuminates the bait. Silooms are cigar-sized plastic tubes with phosphorescent chemicals inside them that activate when the tube is snapped in half. They cost $1 apiece, and a sword boat might go through 5,000 in a trip. The hooks and light sticks are spaced about 30 feet apart, but the exact interval is determined by the speed of the boat. If the captain wants to fish the hooks closer together, he slows down. If he wants to spread them apart, he speeds up. The typical speed for setting out on the Grand Banks is 6 or 7 knots. At that speed, it takes about 4 hours to set out 30 miles of line. Every 3 hooks, the baiter snaps on a ball drop, which floats on the surface and keeps the long line from sinking to the bottom. A typical arrangement is to hang your line at 5 fathoms and dangle your hooks to 12. That's about 70 feet down. Depending on currents and the temperature breaks, that's where swordfish like to feed. Every 4 miles, instead of a ball drop, the baiter clips on a high flyer. The high flyer is a float and aluminum pole with a radar-reflecting square on top. It bobs along on the surface of the ocean and shows up very clearly on the radar screen. Finally, every 8 miles, a radio transmitter is attached. It has a big whip antenna that broadcasts a low-frequency signal back to the boat. This allows the captain to track the gear down if it parts off mid-string. A fully baited long line represents a significant amount of money, and captains have been known to risk the lives of their crew to get them back. 40 miles of monofilament line goes for $1,800. Each of the radio beacon buoys costs $1,800, and there are 6 of them on a long line. The polyballs cost $6 apiece and are set every 3 hooks for 1,000 hooks. The hooks are $1, the light sticks are $1, the squid is $1, and the gangeons are $2. Every night, in other words, a sword boat drops $20,000 worth of gear into the North Atlantic. One of the biggest disputes on a sword boat is whether to set out or not. Crews have hauled in a full gale because their captain misjudged the weather. The baiting usually gets finished up late in the evening, and the Andrea Gale crew hangs their rain gear in the tool room and tramps into the kitchen. They eat dinner quickly, and when they're done, Billy climbs up the companionway to take over the helm from Murph. He checks his Loran bearings, which fix him on the chart, and the video plotter, which fixes him in relation to the main line. The radar is always on and has a range of 15 miles or so. The high flyers on the main line register as small squares on the screen. The VHF is tuned to channel 16, and the single sideband is tuned to 2182 megahertz. They're both emergency channels, and if two boats need to communicate, they contact each other and switch to a separate working channel. At 11 p.m., the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, broadcasts a weather forecast, and the captains generally check in with each other afterward to discuss its finer points. By then, most of the crew has already turned in. They're into a stretch of 20-20-hour workdays, and sleep becomes as coveted as cigarettes. The bunks are bolted against the tapered sides of the bow, and the men fall asleep listening to the diesel engine and the smack of waves against the hull. Underwater, the prop whine and the cavitation of hundreds of thousands of air bubbles radiate outward into the ocean. The sound wraps around the foreshores of Newfoundland, refracts off the temperature discontinuity of the Gulf Stream, and dissipates into the crushing black depths beyond the continental shelf. Low-frequency vibrations propagate almost forever underwater, and the throb of the Andrea Gale's machine